Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2016. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear four short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than three words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. Which street is the new bookshop on? B. What will customers be given on the first morning?
I know many of you were disappointed when our well-loved bookshop on Green Road closed last month. Well, you'll be delighted to hear it's reopening next Saturday, just around the corner on River Lane. To celebrate the reopening, the shop has planned all sorts of events and special offers for customers. Make sure you turn up early on opening day. You'll receive a free calendar if you do, but only until lunchtime. After that, there's a children's session with games and music. They each get a poster to take away with them. So, bring your kids along and make it a day to remember. I know many of you were disappointed when our well-loved bookshop on Green Road closed last month. Well, you'll be delighted to hear it's reopening next Saturday, just around the corner on River Lane. To celebrate the reopening, the shop has planned all sorts of events and special offers for customers. Make sure you turn up early on opening day. You'll receive a free calendar if you do, but only until lunchtime. After that, there's a children's session with games and music. They each get a poster to take away with them. So, bring your kids along and make it a day to remember.
Question 2. A. What is the title that Jacob chooses for the story competition? B. What is the latest date that he can send in his story?
Jacob, are you going to enter that short story competition I told you about?
Oh, I was just thinking about that. I was actually trying to decide what to write, as there's a choice of titles, isn't there?
Yes, you can either call it Coming Home or The Journey. I've chosen the second one.
In that case, I'll go for the other one. I've got some ideas already, but I can't remember what the deadline is. Was it the 5th of January?
That's when they're announcing the winners. You've got to submit it by the 12th of December, so you'll need to get on with it. Jacob, are you going to enter that short story competition I told you about?
Oh, I was just thinking about that. I was actually trying to decide what to write, as there's a choice of titles, isn't there?
Yes, you can either call it Coming Home or The Journey. I've chosen the second one.
In that case, I'll go for the other one. I've got some ideas already, but I can't remember what the deadline is. Was it the 5th of January?
That's when they're announcing the winners. You've got to submit it by the 12th of December, so you'll need to get on with it.
Question 3. A. What topic did Mariam miss in the physics class today? B. Where will Mariam meet her friend this evening?
Hi, Mariam. I hope it was okay at the dentist this morning. I'm just phoning to tell you about the physics lesson you missed. It was a revision class, so the teacher let us choose what to do. Quite a few of us wanted to study atoms again, so we're doing that next. Anyway, we went over energy and got some really useful handouts on it. I've got copies for you too. I'll bring them this evening. I won't have time to come to the cinema with you and your sister, so I'll catch up with you afterwards in the cafe, about 8 o'clock. See you then. Hi, Mariam. I hope it was okay at the dentist this morning. I'm just phoning to tell you about the physics lesson you missed. It was a revision class, so the teacher let us choose what to do. Quite a few of us wanted to study atoms again, so we're doing that next. Anyway, we went over energy and got some really useful handouts on it. I've got copies for you too. I'll bring them this evening. I won't have time to come to the cinema with you and your sister, so I'll catch up with you afterwards in the cafe, about 8 o'clock. See you then.
Question 4. A. What type of holiday do the couple decide to go on this summer? B. What does the woman need to buy?
Have you had a chance to look at the holiday brochure yet?
Yes, the cycling trips look wonderful, and so do the trekking holidays. Though I suppose we should do something different this summer. We could try a sailing trip. What do you think?
I like that idea a lot.
Great. That was easy. Perhaps we should book this evening. Oh, I'll be able to take some amazing pictures if I manage to get a new camera in time. Let's go shopping this weekend. You could get yourself a new backpack at the same time.
Good idea. Have you had a chance to look at the holiday brochure yet?
Yes, the cycling trips look wonderful, and so do the trekking holidays. Though I suppose we should do something different this summer. We could try a sailing trip. What do you think?
I like that idea a lot.
Great. That was easy. Perhaps we should book this evening. Oh, I'll be able to take some amazing pictures if I manage to get a new camera in time. Let's go shopping this weekend. You could get yourself a new backpack at the same time.
Good idea.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by a woman called Janet who spent 5 months in the Antarctic. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Thanks for inviting me here today. My name's Janet Holmes, and I think most of you know I work as a doctor. But last year, I took a 5-month break from my job and went to a place called Port Lockroy, which is on an island in the Antarctic, as a volunteer. I actually worked in one of the world's most remote post offices, quite a change from my usual job. First, I'll tell you a bit about Port Lockroy. It was originally established in 1944 as a base for research scientists, and it remained occupied until 1962, when the base was transferred to another location. The buildings were abandoned, but later they were restored to their original condition. In 1996, they were reopened and are now what's known as a living museum. Around 18,000 visitors come each year to see what life was like for the scientists who were based here, find out more about the Antarctic, and, of course, visit the small gift shop and post office. The whole place is run by the United Kingdom Antarctic Heritage Trust, which was set up to preserve Antarctic buildings and promote public interest in all aspects of the Antarctic, including the history, culture and traditions, and of course the nature. Port Lockroy is only open for 5 months each summer, and it's run by a team of 4 volunteers. They have several jobs to do, including keeping a check on the huge population of penguins, which are under threat from seals, and running the post office and gift shop. Over the 5 month summer season, visitors send around 80,000 letters and postcards, which can take 8 weeks to reach their final destinations. The shop sells a range of souvenirs, including things like key rings, which are my favourite, mugs, which are always in demand, and other things like hats and scarves. Money from visiting tourists is used to fund the site, as well as other places on the continent. The journey to Port Lockroy is an adventure in itself. We travelled by boat from the southern tip of South America. That always takes time because of storms and strong winds in the Antarctic Ocean. However, our boat was unexpectedly trapped by sea ice for 3 days, just a few hundred metres away from our destination. Once we finally arrived, we settled into our new accommodation, which was one small wooden hut for the 4 of us. We knew there wouldn't be much space for us all, but we got on very well. There's no central heating in the post office, and we became used to that quite quickly, but I did miss having electricity there after a while. My 5 month stay went past far too quickly, and I have so many positive memories of my time there. The scenery was unforgettable, and the wildlife was really exciting. It was great meeting visitors from all around the world while staying in such a remote location. You wouldn't expect those two things to go together. But for me, nothing could beat the constant daylight. It hardly got dark at all for a few weeks during my stay. Overall, the whole experience was really memorable.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Thanks for inviting me here today. My name's Janet Holmes, and I think most of you know I work as a doctor. But last year, I took a 5 month break from my job and went to a place called Port Lockroy, which is on an island in the Antarctic, as a volunteer. I actually worked in one of the world's most remote post offices, quite a change from my usual job. First, I'll tell you a bit about Port Lockroy. It was originally established in 1944 as a base for research scientists, and it remained occupied until 1962, when the base was transferred to another location. The buildings were abandoned, but later they were restored to their original condition. In 1996, they were reopened and are now what's known as a living museum. Around 18,000 visitors come each year to see what life was like for the scientists who were based here, find out more about the Antarctic, and, of course, visit the small gift shop and post office. The whole place is run by the United Kingdom Antarctic Heritage Trust, which was set up to preserve Antarctic buildings and promote public interest in all aspects of the Antarctic, including the history, culture and traditions, and of course the nature. Port Lockroy is only open for 5 months each summer, and it's run by a team of 4 volunteers. They have several jobs to do, including keeping a check on the huge population of penguins, which are under threat from seals, and running the post office and gift shop. Over the 5-month summer season, visitors send around 80,000 letters and postcards, which can take 8 weeks to reach their final destinations. The shop sells a range of souvenirs, including things like key rings, which are my favourite, mugs, which are always in demand, and other things like hats and scarves. Money from visiting tourists is used to fund the site, as well as other places on the continent. The journey to Port Lockroy is an adventure in itself. We travelled by boat from the southern tip of South America. That always takes time because of storms and strong winds in the Antarctic Ocean. However, our boat was unexpectedly trapped by sea ice for 3 days, just a few hundred metres away from our destination. Once we finally arrived, we settled into our new accommodation, which was one small wooden hut for the four of us. We knew there wouldn't be much space for us all, but we got on very well. There's no central heating in the post office, and we became used to that quite quickly, but I did miss having electricity there after a while. My 5-month stay went past far too quickly, and I have so many positive memories of my time there. The scenery was unforgettable, and the wildlife was really exciting. It was great meeting visitors from all around the world while staying in such a remote location. You wouldn't expect those two things to go together. But for me, nothing could beat the constant daylight. It hardly got dark at all for a few weeks during my stay. Overall, the whole experience was really memorable.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about children getting pocket money. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recording twice. Speaker 1.
When I was growing up, I didn't get any pocket money whatsoever. If I wanted to buy something, I had to ask my parents. If they thought I needed it, they'd give me some money. And if I didn't, that was that. I hated having to try to persuade them all the time. So I've gone for the opposite approach with my kids. They get a regular amount each week. And they understand there'll be no more until the next week, so they don't spend it all at once.
Speaker 2.
It's funny how my sister and I are so different with our money, even though our parents treated us the same way. When we got our pocket money each week, I'd go straight to the shops to get the latest comic, and sweets, of course. My sister would put her money away and keep it for something she really wanted later on. Even though I got more than her, because she's younger than me, I still spent it all. My sister definitely got it right. She's much better at coping financially than me now.
Speaker 3.
People say that children should earn their pocket money, you know, doing things like tidying their bedroom or washing the car, and that way they learn the value of hard work. Actually, I think that children should be doing those things at home anyway, without having to be paid for it. Don't get me wrong, I think pocket money's a good thing, as it helps children learn to look after themselves. I'm certainly not saying they shouldn't get any money at all.
Speaker 4.
I'm useless with money. My wages never seem to last me very long, and it's not because I don't earn enough. I just spend it all. I'm sure that if I'd had to ask my parents if it was okay to buy things when I was younger, I would have learned to control my spending better. I can't believe the rubbish my brother and I used to buy with our pocket money. I don't understand why our parents never encouraged us to be more careful with it.
Speaker 5.
I get a fixed amount of pocket money each month. It's not much, and way less than some of my friends get. And I don't really understand why, but they constantly seem to be running out of cash and asking for extra. I guess because they have lots to start with, they just think it'll last. Then when it's gone, they expect more. I'm not saying they should just save their money, but they should learn to hold on to it a bit longer at least.
Speaker 6.
I've got an older brother and a younger sister. I'm the middle one. My brother always got more pocket money than me and my sister, and my sister got less than I did. I guess my parents believed that you deserve more as you grow up. We all bought the same stuff, though, so it just didn't seem fair to me. I think the best approach is to reward children for certain things. Give them a small amount for helping out each weekend, for example. Then age doesn't matter, does it?
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
When I was growing up, I didn't get any pocket money whatsoever. If I wanted to buy something, I had to ask my parents. If they thought I needed it, they'd give me some money. And if I didn't, that was that. I hated having to try to persuade them all the time. So I've gone for the opposite approach with my kids. They get a regular amount each week, and they understand there'll be no more until the next week, so they don't spend it all at once.
Speaker 2.
It's funny how my sister and I are so different with our money, even though our parents treated us the same way. When we got our pocket money each week, I'd go straight to the shops to get the latest comic, and sweets, of course. My sister would put her money away and keep it for something she really wanted later on. Even though I got more than her, because she's younger than me, I still spent it all. My sister definitely got it right. She's much better at coping financially than me now.
Speaker 3.
People say that children should earn their pocket money, you know, doing things like tidying their bedroom or washing the car, and that way they learn the value of hard work. Actually, I think that children should be doing those things at home anyway, without having to be paid for it. Don't get me wrong, I think pocket money's a good thing, as it helps children learn to look after themselves. I'm certainly not saying they shouldn't get any money at all.
Speaker 4.
I'm useless with money. My wages never seem to last me very long, and it's not because I don't earn enough. I just spend it all. I'm sure that if I'd had to ask my parents if it was okay to buy things when I was younger, I would have learned to control my spending better. I can't believe the rubbish my brother and I used to buy with our pocket money. I don't understand why our parents never encouraged us to be more careful with it.
Speaker 5.
I get a fixed amount of pocket money each month. It's not much, and way less than some of my friends get. And I don't really understand why, but they constantly seem to be running out of cash and asking for extra. I guess because they have lots to start with, they just think it'll last. Then when it's gone, they expect more. I'm not saying they should just save their money, but they should learn to hold on to it a bit longer at least.
Speaker 6.
I've got an older brother and a younger sister. I'm the middle one. My brother always got more pocket money than me and my sister, and my sister got less than I did. I guess my parents believed that you deserve more as you grow up. We all bought the same stuff, though, so it just didn't seem fair to me. I think the best approach is to reward children for certain things. Give them a small amount for helping out each weekend, for example. Then age doesn't matter, does it?
That is the end of the short talks about pocket money. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear a radio presenter talking to a woman called Aisha who enjoys long-distance running. Listen to their conversation and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the conversation twice.
Today, in our latest programme on athletics, I'm going to talk to Aisha Berman, a long-distance runner. Aisha, hello and welcome.
Hello.
Why don't you begin by telling us how you got into long-distance running?
I've always loved running. When I was a teenager, I used to get a monthly magazine to read all about it and get tips on how to improve. Then my mum heard someone on the radio talking about running marathons and she told me about it. I wanted to find out more. Then, after seeing a documentary on television about a man who did what's known as an ultramarathon, I decided to try it.
So, what's an ultramarathon?
Anything over 42 kilometres. That type of race tends to be in the countryside rather than on streets, so there's more to look at and enjoy. That's the main thing for me. You'd also be surprised that they're not as punishing as you'd expect, mostly because you run on softer ground. And the feeling of competition isn't as intense as it can be in shorter races.
Even so, some of these races must be quite tough, I guess.
They can be, but just because a race is over a longer distance doesn't necessarily mean it'll be more challenging. I normally look up the percentage of people who actually complete the race. It's higher for easier races, of course. Some people want to know if there are any hills on the route. But I don't find going up or downhill too tricky myself.
Tell us about some races you've done recently.
Well, I tried a few 50-kilometre races in America this summer. One called Chuckanut in Washington has some tough climbs, but then some long flat stretches. That contrast appealed to me best of all. Another was in Texas, called Rocky Raccoon. That involves going around a shorter route twice, which some like, but it isn't my preference. And Bighorn in Wyoming, oh, the mountains were spectacular, though I wasn't feeling my best that day.
Have you ever thought about doing the Sahara Marathon?
Everyone talks about that race. It's like the one and only race to say you've done. It started off with just a handful of people taking part, though recently it's grown enormously. I'd be put off by that, I think, and it costs quite a bit to enter. But it's supposed to be very well organised, so I guess that's fair enough.
I've heard some people like running at night time. Do you?
Actually, I love it. I wear a head torch, and you only see what's in the circle of light, even insects and small animals. So it's like the ground beneath your feet disappears as soon as you take another step forward. And because you only see what's close by, it seems to make the scenery speed past you. It gives you the impression you're running quicker than you actually are.
Aisha, there'll be some people listening today who want to take up running. What advice have you got for them?
Lots of people tell you to work out a schedule and stick to it. That can put you off, I think. Try going out whenever you have the chance. You'll find out if you run better earlier or later, for example. And of course, there are plenty of running groups too, which can be very sociable. Though I'd say you're unlikely to do what suits you best that way.
Thanks. And finally, what's next for you?
Well, something I've always wanted to do is work with teenagers, get them interested in running like I was at their age. I'm going to set up my own company in a year or so to do that. I've also been asked by a publisher to produce a guide to long-distance running. That'll be fun. Though the deadline is coming up shortly, so I'll have to get on with it.
Well, good luck. And thank you very much for talking to us today.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today, in our latest programme on athletics, I'm going to talk to Aisha Berman, a long-distance runner. Aisha, hello and welcome.
Hello.
Why don't you begin by telling us how you got into long-distance running?
I've always loved running. When I was a teenager, I used to get a monthly magazine to read all about it and get tips on how to improve. Then my mum heard someone on the radio talking about running marathons, and she told me about it. I wanted to find out more. Then, after seeing a documentary on television about a man who did what's known as an ultramarathon, I decided to try it.
So, what's an ultramarathon?
Anything over 42 kilometres. That type of race tends to be in the countryside rather than on streets, so there's more to look at and enjoy. That's the main thing for me. You'd also be surprised that they're not as punishing as you'd expect, mostly because you run on softer ground. And the feeling of competition isn't as intense as it can be in shorter races.
Even so, some of these races must be quite tough, I guess.
They can be, but just because a race is over a longer distance doesn't necessarily mean it'll be more challenging. I normally look up the percentage of people who actually complete the race. It's higher for easier races, of course. Some people want to know if there are any hills on the route, but I don't find going up or downhill too tricky myself.
Tell us about some races you've done recently.
Well, I tried a few 50-kilometer races in America this summer. One called Chuckanut in Washington has some tough climbs, but then some long, flat stretches. That contrast appealed to me best of all. Another was in Texas, called Rocky Raccoon. That involves going around a shorter route twice, which some like, but it isn't my preference. And Bighorn in Wyoming, oh, the mountains were spectacular, though I wasn't feeling my best that day.
Have you ever thought about doing the Sahara Marathon?
Everyone talks about that race. It's like the one and only race to say you've done. It started off with just a handful of people taking part, though recently it's grown enormously. I'd be put off by that, I think, and it costs quite a bit to enter. But it's supposed to be very well organised, so I guess that's fair enough.
I've heard some people like running at night time. Do you?
Actually, I love it. I wear a head torch, and you only see what's in the circle of light, even insects and small animals. So it's like the ground beneath your feet disappears as soon as you take another step forward. And because you only see what's close by, it seems to make the scenery speed past you. It gives you the impression you're running quicker than you actually are.
Aisha, there'll be some people listening today who want to take up running. What advice have you got for them?
Lots of people tell you to work out a schedule and stick to it. That can put you off, I think. Try going out whenever you have the chance. You'll find out if you run better earlier or later, for example. And of course, there are plenty of running groups too, which can be very sociable. Though I'd say you're unlikely to do what suits you best that way.
Thanks. And finally, what's next for you?
Well, something I've always wanted to do is work with teenagers. Get them interested in running like I was at their age. I'm going to set up my own company in a year or so to do that. I've also been asked by a publisher to produce a guide to long-distance running. That'll be fun. Though the deadline is coming up shortly, so I'll have to get on with it.
Well, good luck. And thank you very much for talking to us today.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8, Part A. You will hear an archaeology tutor giving a talk about things that are found on the shores of the River Thames in London. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I know quite a few of you are planning to go on the study trip to London next year, so today I'm going to tell you about an area that's of interest to archaeologists in the city. As you know, the river that flows through London is called the Thames. In the 19th century, groups of children who were known as mudlarks used to make a living by working their way along the shores of the Thames, gathering wood, bones or coal, which they would later get cash for. They would also come across lots of broken bottles. Green glass would have been the most profitable, although they would have commonly found pieces of brown or clear glass in the mud too. The name mudlark was appropriate, as the children would have been covered in mud, and they would have had to sort through all sorts of rubbish, including dead animals, to find the things that they could make money from. These days, the Thames is actually one of the cleanest metropolitan rivers in the world, but for many centuries it was treated as if it was the city's rubbish bin. The name mudlark is still used to refer to amateur archaeologists who look for interesting objects along the shores of the river. There are only about 50 of these people. They all have to be approved by the Museum of London in order to become a member of the Society of Thames Mudlarks. Quite a select organisation. Anything they find has to be registered with the museum, and although they don't need to have any particular qualification, they do have to be in possession of a licence, which is usually granted after someone has spent 2 years searching for objects along the shores of the Thames. I expect you're asking yourselves what sort of objects a mudlark might discover these days. There's a very impressive collection on display in the Museum of London, including a large amount of jewellery and clothes. In terms of quantity, a pin is what turns up most frequently. In medieval times, people had hundreds of these, and they were both exported and imported in great numbers. Experts at the museum look at each object to see if they can find out more about where it came from, or even who made it. For example, clay pipes might have small marks on them, which means it can be established that they were produced in the 18th century. Buttons are regularly brought in, and it's not uncommon that the tailor who sewed them on a piece of clothing can be identified, as they often engraved their name on them. It's sometimes possible to work out who the owner may have been too. I'm going to show you some images of mudlarks at work these days, as well as some of their finds. But first, does anyone have any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
I know quite a few of you are planning to go on the study trip to London next year, so today I'm going to tell you about an area that's of interest to archaeologists in the city. As you know, the river that flows through London is called the Thames. In the 19th century, groups of children who were known as mudlarks used to make a living by working their way along the shores of the Thames, gathering wood, bones, or coal, which they would later get cash for. They would also come across lots of broken bottles. Green glass would have been the most profitable, although they would have commonly found pieces of brown or clear glass in the mud too. The name mudlark was appropriate, as the children would have been covered in mud, and they would have had to sort through all sorts of rubbish, including dead animals, to find the things that they could make money from. These days, the Thames is actually one of the cleanest metropolitan rivers in the world, but for many centuries it was treated as if it was the city's rubbish bin. The name mudlark is still used to refer to amateur archaeologists who look for interesting objects along the shores of the river. There are only about 50 of these people. They all have to be approved by the Museum of London in order to become a member of the Society of Thames Mudlarks. Quite a select organisation. Anything they find has to be registered with the museum, and although they don't need to have any particular qualification, they do have to be in possession of a licence, which is usually granted after someone has spent 2 years searching for objects along the shores of the Thames. I expect you're asking yourselves what sort of objects a mudlark might discover these days. There's a very impressive collection on display in the Museum of London, including a large amount of jewellery and clothes. In terms of quantity, a pin is what turns up most frequently. In medieval times, people had hundreds of these, and they were both exported and imported in great numbers. Experts at the museum look at each object to see if they can find out more about where it came from, or even who made it. For example, clay pipes might have small marks on them, which means it can be established that they were produced in the 18th century. Buttons are regularly brought in, and it's not uncommon that the tailor who sewed them on a piece of clothing can be identified, as they often engraved their name on them. It's sometimes possible to work out who the owner may have been too. I'm going to show you some images of mudlarks at work these days, as well as some of their finds. But first, does anyone have any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 8, part B. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about mudlarks and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
What did you think about that talk on mudlarks yesterday?
Really interesting. I've been reading about it. Have you found out any more?
I've had a look at some websites. I thought it might be possible to get in touch with someone who's a mudlark and ask them to take us along the river when we're in London next year.
What a great idea. So what did you find out?
Well, what I didn't realise is how dangerous it can be on the Thames. There's all sorts of information online about this that you need to know, like the hours of the day when the tide comes in and goes out. Apparently, it's really easy to get cut off if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm. Can you get maps to find out the best places to go?
Yes, and where not to go. Actually, people like you and I are only allowed on the south side of the river. Although some of the stretches on the north look as if they might be easy to get to.
Hmm, OK. I want to look online to find out more about the objects that have been discovered.
Isn't it incredible how well preserved some of them are? Considering how long they've been in the mud.
Oh, I read about that. It's the lack of air in it that causes this.
I see. I thought there might be certain chemicals in it. What else did you discover?
Well, I got hold of an article written by a journalist who spent an afternoon working by the river with a mudlark. You should read it.
I will.
Anyway, she found a few items. She said the first thing she spotted was shiny, and then when she moved the mud from around it, she wondered if it could be part of a tiny gold ring. It turned out to be a section of chain, which would have been made by hand in around the 15th century. Incredible, isn't it?
It is. I love the fact that you can discover so much about an object like that.
Yes. Another thing this journalist found was what she thought was a coin, and they took it to the museum to be examined. It was actually a 17th century token, which would have been used as an alternative to money. The museum has got lots of these. There's one made by a shopkeeper, for example. The one she dug up happened to have been produced by a baker, and they've even discovered that he came from a town called Reading, which is not far from London. It's quite amazing what you can find out from one little object like that, isn't it?
Now you will hear the conversation again.
What did you think about that talk on mudlarks yesterday?
Really interesting. I've been reading about it. Have you found out any more?
I've had a look at some websites. I thought it might be possible to get in touch with someone who's a mudlark and ask them to take us along the river when we're in London next year.
What a great idea. So what did you find out?
Well, what I didn't realise is how dangerous it can be on the Thames. There's all sorts of information online about this that you need to know, like the hours of the day when the tide comes in and goes out. Apparently, it's really easy to get cut off if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm. Can you get maps to find out the best places to go?
Yes, and where not to go. Actually, people like you and I are only allowed on the south side of the river. Although some of the stretches on the north look as if they might be easy to get to.
OK. I want to look online to find out more about the objects that have been discovered.
Isn't it incredible how well preserved some of them are? Considering how long they've been in the mud.
Oh, I read about that. It's the lack of air in it that causes this.
I see. I thought there might be certain chemicals in it. What else did you discover?
Well, I got hold of an article written by a journalist who spent an afternoon working by the river with a mudlark. You should read it.
I will.
Anyway, she found a few items. She said the first thing she spotted was shiny, and then when she moved the mud from around it, she wondered if it could be part of a tiny gold ring. It turned out to be a section of chain, which would have been made by hand in around the 15th century. Incredible, isn't it?
It is. I love the fact that you can discover so much about an object like that.
Yes. Another thing this journalist found was what she thought was a coin, and they took it to the museum to be examined. It was actually a 17th century token, which would have been used as an alternative to money. The museum has got lots of these. There's one made by a shopkeeper, for example. The one she dug up happened to have been produced by a baker, and they've even discovered that he came from a town called Reading, which is not far from London. It's quite amazing what you can find out from one little object like that, isn't it?
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.